Miss Krebs from our anthropology department will introduce our speaker for this evening.
In the community of scientific investigators and the international world of pure science, our distinguished visiting speaker, Mr. Gregory Bateson, truly requires no introduction. His brilliance and his creative work in the difficult and delicate border of psychiatry, anthropology, communication, and cybernetics are not only well known, but they are greatly respected. It would not be appropriate, even for this audience, to list the many honors, awards, and recognitions accorded to our speaker, for it is not the quantity of culturally defined honors that is most significant, but rather the quality of the man, his mind, and experience, and his contributions to the advancement of human knowledge. Briefly, however, you should know that Mr. Bateson was educated in the British tradition, and on completion of his formal instruction at Cambridge, spent some 2 decades in various parts of the world, engaging in intensive field work in the Pacific area and in Asia, notably in New Guinea, New Britain, Bali, Ceylon, India, Burma, and China. At the end of World War II, he turned his attention to a variety of special research projects which focused on some aspect of communication. These projects are particularly notable in the field of study of schizophrenic communication, as well as his studies in family communication systems and the environment of the family as a formative matrix in the development of aberrant psychological states in individual family members. More recently, Mr. Bateson has directed his attention to working with non-human communication systems among the higher mammals, and notably among the porpoises. He is presently the associate director for research at the Oceanic Institute in Hawaii, and this work is ongoing. To all of his research, Mr. Bateson has brought the spirit of free inquiry and creative synthesis, which is the hallmark of the great scientific investigator. We everyday Americans are very apt to be inclined to equate notoriety with fame and fame with greatness. The fact is that these are very distinct categories. Mr. Bateson's life and work have escaped mere notoriety, and I think he will agree with me that he is blissfully free of the tedium of popular fame of the order of the Beatles or Al Capp. However, Mr. Bateson is indeed uniquely endowed with those qualities which we must term real scientific greatness. Thus, it is our very rare privilege tonight to hear one of the truly great minds of our own century discuss the topic from Versailles to cybernetics. May I present Mr. Gregory Bateson. Thank you.
Dr. Krebs, ladies and gentlemen, am I audible? Am I comfortably audible? Sort of adding final thoughts to what I wanted to say about the different perspectives on history, on current history, of those older than 25 and younger than 25. Some words are much more thunderous than any that I might be able to compose began to sort of run in my mind as I flew in this morning. One of these groups of words is the fathers have eaten bitter fruit and the children's teeth are set on edge. Another is the statement of Joyce that history is that nightmare from which there is no awakening. Another is the sins of the fathers shall be visited on the children, even to the third and fourth generation of those that hate me. And lastly, not so immediately relevant, but still I think relevant to the problem of social mechanism, he who would do good to another must do so in minute particulars. The general good is the plea of patriots, politicians, and knaves. In other words, we are talking about some rather serious things. I called this lecture From Versailles to Cybernetics. The word cybernetics is now generally familiar, is it? How many want to volunteer hands to state unfamiliarity with the word? Okay. Am I still comfortably audible? Like that? Okay. The question is, you see, what one is going to count as important in the history of the last 60 years. For your information, I am 62. I shall be very shortly. And as I began to think about what I have seen of history in my lifetime, it seemed to me that I'd really only seen two events that would rate as really important from an anthropologist's point of view. One was the events leading up to the Treaty of Versailles, and the other was the cybernetic breakthrough. You may be a little shocked that I haven't mentioned the A-bomb, and I haven't mentioned World War II. I have not mentioned the spread of the automobile or of the radio and TV, and many other things. that have occurred in the last 60 years. The criterion that I use to say, is this event historically important, needs to be defined. Mammals in general, and we among them, care extremely not about episodes, but about the patterns of their relationships. When you open the refrigerator door and the cat comes up and makes certain sounds, she is not talking about liver or milk, though you may know very well that is what she wants, and you may be able to guess correctly and give her that, if there's any in the icebox. What she is saying is something about the relationship between herself and you. If you wanted to translate her message into words, it would be something like, quote, dependency, dependency, dependency. And perhaps, ain't it grand? She's talking, in fact, about a rather abstract pattern of a relationship. And from that assertion of a pattern, you are expected to deduce, to go from the general to the specific, and you get out milk or liver or whatever it is. Now, this is crucial. This is what mammals are about. They are concerned with patterns of relationship, with where they stand in love, hate, respect, dependency, trust, and similar abstractions vis-a-vis somebody else. This is where it hurts when we are put in the wrong. If we trust and find that which we have trusted was untrustworthy, if we distrust and find that which we distrusted was in fact trustworthy, we feel bad. And the pain that human beings can suffer, or that other mammals can suffer, from this type of error is extreme. If, therefore, we really want to ask what are the significant points in history, what we really, to put that question in a more specific way, we have to ask, what are the points in history where attitudes were changed?
Well, they'll be able to see you better.
Okay, can you still hear me comfortably? You see, suppose you think of the house thermostat in your home. The weather changes outdoors, the temperature of the room falls, the thermometer device, thermometer switch in the living room goes through its business and switches on the furnace. And the furnace warms the room, and when the room's hot, the thermometer switch turns it off again. What is called a homeostatic circuit or a servo circuit. Now, there's also a little thing in the living room on the wall by which you set the thermostat. You say the house has been too cold for the last week, and you jiffy it up from its present setting, and it will now oscillate around a new level, swing up and down. No amount of weather, heat or cold or whatever will change that what's called the bias, that setting on the wall. The house will oscillate, it'll get hotter, it'll get cooler, according to various circumstances and the working of the thermostatic mechanism, but the setting of the mechanism will not be changed by those changes. When you go and you move that switch, that dial, pointer, you will change what we may call the attitude. Technically, the technical term is the bias of the thermostat. Now, the question about history is where, at what moments in history, has the setting been changed? The episodic working out of events under a single stationary setting is really trivial. And it's with this sort of thought in mind that I've said that the two really important historic events in my life were the Treaty of Versailles and the discovery of cybernetics. Now, let me for a moment look at the... No, let me consider... most of you probably hardly know how the Treaty of Versailles came into being. The story is very simple. World War I dragged on for a heck of a long time, and the Germans were fairly obviously losing. And a gentleman, George Creel, a public relations man, and I don't want you to forget that this man was the granddaddy of modern public relations, or perhaps only father of modern public relations, had an idea. And the idea was that maybe the Germans would surrender if we offered them soft armistice terms. He therefore drew up a set of soft terms according to which there would be no punitive measures, no reparations, no territorial changes. And these terms were drawn up in 14 points. These 14 points he passed on to President Wilson. If you are going to deceive somebody, you had better get an honest man to carry the message. President Wilson was an almost pathologically honest man. He delivered the message, and the Germans surrendered. We, British and American, no, I think mainly British in this, continued, of course, to blockade Germany because we didn't want them to get uppity before the treaty was signed. So they continued to starve for another year or so. And the treaty was finally drawn up by Clemenceau, who was... Remember Clemenceau, the tiger, who wanted revenge against Germany, Lloyd George, who felt it would be politically expedient to get a lot of reparations out of Germany and some revenge, Wilson, who had to be bamboozled along as best could be, and whenever Wilson would sort of wonder about those dear 14 points of his, they'd take him out into the war cemeteries and make him feel ashamed of not being angry with the Germans. Who was the other? Rolando was the other, an Italian. He didn't carry any weight anyway. This was one of the great sellouts in the history of our civilization. A most extraordinary event. It led fairly directly into World War II. This is one of the main complaints of Nazi Germany. It also led, and this is perhaps more interesting than the fact of its leading to World War II, it also led to the demoralization of German politics. If you promise your boy something and renege on him, the whole thing being framed in this high ethical plane, you will probably find that not only is he very angry with you, but also that his moral attitudes deteriorate as long as he feels the unfair whiplash of what you're doing to him. It's not only that World War II was the appropriate response of a nation which had been treated in this particular way, but it is also the fact that the demoralization of that nation was expectable from this sort of treatment. This is why I say that the Treaty of Versailles was an attitudinal turning point. I imagine that we have another couple of generations of after effects of that particular piece of sellout, of deceit, to work through. We are, in fact, like members of the House of Atreus in Greek tragedy, where the murders occur, what, first in adultery and then the murder of the children who get served up for dinner between Atreus and Thyestes. Nobody correcting me anyway. Then in the next generation you have the trouble with Agamemnon, and finally you end up with the murder of Clytemnestra and her boyfriend Aegisthus and the whole business with Orestes and Electra. The tragedy of oscillating and self-propagating destruction down the generations. These things do not stop in a day. They go on. Now, if you come into the middle of one of these things, the middle generations of the House of Atreus feel they are living in a pretty crazy universe. From the point of view of the people who started the mess, it's not so crazy. They know what happened and how they got there. The people down the scale who were not there at the beginning of the mess find themselves living in a crazy universe, find themselves, in fact, crazy, because if your universe is crazy, you are. That is, you are if you try to be sane. It's like this, you see. To take a dose of LSD, what they call acid, I understand, is all right, and you will have the experience of being more or less crazy. But this will make quite good sense because you know you took the dose of LSD. If, on the other hand, you take LSD by accident and don't know what's hit you and find yourself going crazy and don't know how you got there, this is a terrifying and horrible experience. And this is a much more serious and terrible experience than the voluntary few hours of hallucination, which may indeed be not unpleasant, that you get if you knew you took the LSD. All right, now consider the difference between my generation and the people who are under 25. We all live in the same relatively crazy universe, whose craziness is related, amongst other things, and whose distrust, hypocrisy, and the rest of it is related back, amongst other things, and especially at the international level, to the 14 points in the Treaty of Versailles. Now, this doesn't disturb me very much, because I know how we got here. I can remember my father reading the 14 points at the breakfast table and saying, by golly, they're going to give them a decent armistice, a decent peace, or something of the kind. And I can remember, but I will not attempt to verbalize, the sort of thing he said when the Treaty of Versailles came out. It wasn't printable. So I know, more or less, how we got here. But the 25-year-olds really haven't the slightest idea how we got here. From their point of view, we are absolutely crazy, and nobody knows, and they don't know, what sort of historic event led to this craziness. The fathers have eaten bitter fruit, and the children's teeth are set on edge. It's all very well for the fathers. They know what they ate. The children don't know what was eaten and led to this mess. Now, let's begin to look a little at what sort of expectation you'd have for people in the aftermath of major deception. Previous to World War I, it was generally assumed that compromise and a little hypocrisy are a very important ingredient in the ordinary comfortableness of life. If you read Erewhon Revisited, for example, which is earlier, what, about 1880 or 1890, of Samuel Butler, his Utopia, all his principal characters in the novel have got themselves into an awful mess. Many of them are due to be executed, and others are due for public scandal, and the religious system of the nation is threatened with all sorts of exposure. And these disasters are smoothed out by Mrs. Idgran. The novel Erewhon is nowhere backwards, is the name of the country, and Idgran is Grundy backwards. Mrs. Grundy, the guardian of Erewhonian morals, smooths the whole thing out by careful fitting it together like a jigsaw puzzle so that nobody is really hurt and nobody is disgraced.
Still less is anybody executed. This is a very comfortable philosophy, and a little hypocrisy and a little compromise, on the whole, oil the wheels of social life. And certainly everybody my age would more or less agree with that. The pre-25-year-olds, and even some of the older figures that I see before me, are a little shocked at my saying that hypocrisy is the natural lubricant of life, and compromise. The rising generation feels that compromise is always hypocritical, and that hypocrisy is always wicked, it is square, it is etc., etc. They feel very strongly that almost everything emanating from large institutions is hypocritical, square, compromising, etc. You see, there's something wrong from where they sit. They don't know how they got there. They are perfectly correct that there is something wrong. The something wrong is of the nature of a deceit and a hypocrisy, at least insofar as it goes back to Versailles, but probably it goes back to a great many other things too. This is really only a key sample item that it goes back to, but is one of the important sample items, I think, and especially internationally. And there is a problem then of what sort of attitude you can adopt to yourself and to the world around you if you come out of this complex, undiagnosed sort of corruption. And of course, the natural responses are puritanical. Not sexual puritanism, because it is not a sexual deceit that lies in the background so much. And you get an extreme Puritanism against compromise, a Puritanism against hypocrisy. And this ends up very correctly as a reduction of life to little pieces. It is the big integrated structures of life that seem to have carried the lunacy, and so you try to focus down on the smallest things. He who would do good to another must do so in minute particulars. The general good is the plea of the, what is it? The patriot, the politician, and the knave. And the general good is one of the things that smells of hypocrisy to the rising generation. I think correctly. I think the general good is usually a good deal of nonsense. And I don't doubt if you ask George Creel to justify the 14 points in the Treaty of Versailles, he would justify them by urging the general good. It is possible that that little operation of his saved a few thousand American lives in 1918. I don't know how many it cost in World War II and since in Korea and Vietnam. So that World War II, you see, isn't really a historical event of any importance. It's merely the working out of a pattern which was already set. And what is important is the machinery by which the human attitudes were shifted from one position to another. And I think Versailles was one of the important things. What we have to do, you see, in looking at history, is to distinguish the etiology, as the doctors would say, from the symptoms. People may die of symptoms, oh sure. And in history, civilizations may die of symptoms. But if you want to understand history, it's the etiology you have to look at. And the etiology is continually acting in different ways owing to the different epochs at which people enter upon the historic stage. Those who live through Versailles have a different view of the whole thing from those who came after and found themselves crazy in a crazy world without knowing how they got there. Now, a very curious thing happened in approximately 1946-47, and this I was in on. This was the growing together of a number of ideas which had developed in different places during World War II. I refer to it as cybernetics in the title, or communication theory. Information theory is another word. Systems theory is another word. Ideas which were generated in Vienna under Bertal Anffy, in Harvard under Wiener, in Princeton under von Neumann, in the Bell Telephone Labs with Shannon, Cambridge with Craik. All these separate developments in different intellectual centers dealing with communicational problems. The problem of what sort of a thing is an organized system. You will notice that everything I've said about history and about Versailles is a discussion of organized systems and their properties. A very crude discussion, I grant you. I'm not a historian, and the entities, the societies and individuals and their interactions are enormously complicated in such a story. But what I want to say is that we are now developing a certain amount of rigorous scientific understanding of these very mysterious processes. Not by any means a complete understanding. But our knowledge today is way ahead of anything that George Creel, who was an applied scientist before his time, before the science was ripe to be applied, anything that he could have said. First of all, for example, one of the roots of cybernetics goes back to Whitehead and Russell and what are called the logical types and the principle that the name is not the thing named and the name of a name is not the name and so on up a ladder. A message about war is in a sense not part of the war. Let me put it this way. The message, quote, let's play chess, unquote, is not a move in the game of chess. It is a message in a more abstract language than the language on the board of the game. The message, let's make peace on such and such terms, is not within the same ethical system as the deceits and tricks of battle. They say all is fair in love and war. Yes, within love and war, but outside and about love and war, the ethics are a little different. Now, that sort of a formal statement is one arising out of games theory, mathematical rigors of various kinds, and begins to be an approach to things like George Creel, which is much stronger, or seems stronger in 20th century eyes at least, than any sort of good boy, naughty boy sort of statement. The ethics can be looked at with formality, rigor, logic, mathematics, and all that stuff, and stand on a different sort of basis from mere invocational preachments. And I included cybernetics as the second historic event of some importance in my lifetime because I have a rather dim hope that with this understanding, if we can bring ourselves to use it with some honesty and to understand a little bit of what we're doing, maybe it would help us to find our way out of the maze of hallucinations that we have created around ourselves. I don't know. It is, at any rate, a contribution to a change, not simply a change in direction of attitude, but a change in understanding of what an attitude is. The very sort of stance that I've taken in choosing what is important in history, saying that the important things are the moments at which attitude is determined, the moments at which the bias of the thermostat is changed. This attitude is derived in a very general way, and we're not going to talk mathematics here because I don't have a blackboard and I'm not a mathematician. But these are thoughts shaped by events from 1946 and after. They are the beginnings, I think, and there are many people like me who feel that these are the beginnings of possibly a sane ethic, of possibly making sane choices about how to organize the world. I had thought of including the atom bomb among the list, but I think the truth of the matter is that what was important about the atom bomb was that it came into a world where international attitudes had certain characteristics, going back, amongst other things, to Versailles. If it had come into a world, say, in which Wilson's 14 points had been acted on, the atom bomb might have looked very different to all of us. But the bomb in itself really is only an episodic matter, and what we do with it depends more on the state of our attitudinal system at the moment when it is discovered and made available and developed and so on. Now, there's one other rather awkward matter. And that is, all right, we now have a lot of cybernetics, a lot of games theory, a lot of understanding, or the beginnings of understanding, of complex systems. Any understanding can be distorted in various destructive ways. I'm inclined to think that cybernetics is the biggest bite out of the fruit of the tree of knowledge that we've taken, probably in the last 2,000 years. It can still be very indigestible. Most such bites out of the fruit of knowledge have proved to be rather indigestible. It has a certain amount of integrity within itself to help us not to be seduced by it into more lunacy. But it's not a very... we can't really trust it to keep us from sin. This is this sort of point. The State Departments of several nations, I believe, are today using what is called games theory, backed up by computers, as a way of deciding international policy. In a sense, this is a very logical thing to do. What you do is you consider what seem to be the rules of the game of international interaction, and you consider the distribution of cards, strengths, weapons, strategic points, grievances, etc., over the geography and the identified nations. And then you ask the computer, what should be our next move to minimize the chances of our losing the game? Or conceivably to maximize the chances of our winning it. Usually to minimize the chances of our losing it, because we're all cowards. And the computer cranks and heaves and gives you an answer, which there is some temptation to follow. After all, if you follow the computer, you are a little less responsible, can be held a little less responsible than if you made up your own mind And all doctors are now going to do diagnosis by computers, and no doubt all nations will work out their policies by computers for very much the same reasons. Now, if you do this, what you have done is to assert by the move which you took that you support the rules of the game which you fed into the computer. You have affirmed the rules of that game. No doubt nations of the other side also have computers and are playing similar games and are affirming the rules of the game that they are feeding to their computers, so that we get a system in which what were perhaps a little bit flexible rules of international interaction become more and more rigid rules of international interaction. I submit to you that what's wrong with the international field is that the rules need changing. The question is not what's the best thing to do with the rules as they are at the moment. The question is, how can we get away from the rules which we've been operating on for the last 10 or 20 years, whatever it is? The problem is to change the rules. And insofar as we let our cybernetic inventions, the computers, lead us into more and more rigid situations, we shall, in fact, be maltreating and abusing the first hopeful thing we've had around probably since 1918. I don't know. I'm no searcher in crystal balls. All I can do is to say that looking over the 60 years, well, of course, I've not seen 60 years. I'm 62 now. I was just beginning to notice what was happening, I suppose, about 1918. I was 14 then. 14. And I can't look into crystal balls and predict. All I can do is to say, come sit where I sit and look where I look, and do you see the same thing? And what I see is quite doubtful, but it has little bits of hope in it. One of the things, too, which I think should contribute to that hope is what I referred to as the Puritanism of the Beat generation. It's awfully destructive, it's awfully angry, it's awfully sour, and it's awfully dull, most of it. On the other hand, it's almost unseducible. It's like cats rather than dogs, you know. A dog will do anything for a bit of meat, but cats will only become experimental animals if you put them in escape boxes. There's a strength to that position, a non-bribability. And perhaps some of these kids will help to keep us from abusing the cybernetic inventions and the cybernetic theoretic approaches. Now, I think I've said as much as I dare say, and I'm ready to answer some questions if you would like to shoot them at me.
Suggest if you have your questions, if you would write them out on a card and then I can repeat them so the rest of the audience can hear what the question is, and then Dr. Bateson can respond to this.
Do you have a convention?
I forget about this modern technology. All right, go ahead.
Based on your knowledge of how systems change, could you make any predictive description of what might be the character of a change in the future of the system as a system, such that it would not generate conflict in the same manner that it does now? Or generate less?
Was the question audible? Understanding, of course, that any prediction is virtually impossible, but one can try at it. Let me deal with another point and then come to your question, may I? One of the implications of cybernetic theory, I think, or shall we say the cybernetic revolution, as it's now being called, is that where in the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century, man became enormously arrogant about what he thought he could do in way of control of the universe and of himself, I think the cybernetic revolution has an almost exactly contrary effect, indicating that man has very limited control, and control which is limited within definable limits of what he can plan and what he can predict. The systems in which we are part are almost all of them what are called stochastic systems. They contain large degrees of random alternatives, and this fact, in a systematic way, makes a good deal of planning and a good deal of prediction in principle impossible. And it is appropriate for man to have a good deal more humility today about planning his social systems, planning the ecology of the animals and plants around him, than he had before. I've just come from Hawaii, and in Hawaii it is very evident that planned ecology doesn't work. It only leads to mongooses, which you see all over the place. Now, let me return to the question, which is what sorts of change in the organized system might lead either to the elimination of conflict or to the reduction of conflict? Is that about it? I think the first change that I would go to bat for, if I were a politically active person, and I suppose in opening my mouth at all I am, would be an extension of the time perspective in our computations. You see, all right, we're engaged in a war with nation X. We are fairly clear, and this is one of the major rules of modern warfare, is that you do not destroy nation X, even if you win. You destroy a lot of individuals, but you don't, in the end, destroy the nation. So, one of the long-time effects of anybody fighting nation X is to strengthen nation X. These are interactive systems. They work very much like the immunological systems of your body, or they work as penicillin, the antibiotics, work upon the bacteria. The antibiotics strengthen the bacteria. The diseases strengthen your body. You see, it all works backwards. And in fact, the more we fight against either China or her satellites, the more we induce them to become strong. And of course, the more they fight against us, the more they induce us to become strong. It goes both ways, but always, as you might say, backwards. The idea that you can, over a long time, make them weaker by fighting them is not correct. Over a short time, you can. Now, if our computations were to think in terms of 20 to 30 year spans instead of 2 to 5 year spans, I think we might have a very different attitude towards the whole idea of international conflict and the whole idea of what benefits you can get by such conflict. There are other answers, and the question is complicated, but
what types of changes do you think that man would have to go through in his general cultural patterns, if there is such a thing as a general cultural pattern, in order to adjust to some of the economic and changes in life ways that cybernation will in all probability bring about for him, such things as not working and having not to worry about things like this?
Do I understand what you're asking? Is that how will we have to change in order to deal with such things as the technological unemployment that cybernation threatens? I think I'm going to count that as outside the relevance of what I can talk about tonight. That's a new subject and a very complex one. The subject which I regard as within scope tonight is of what changes in man are introduced by the philosophy of cybernetics rather than by the technology of cybernation. And this I've sort of touched on already in saying that a much greater humility regarding the nature of control and the possibility of control.
My question is, what do you think is more important in communication for the other person to play along with the game or to understand, to talk about the game of chess or to play it. For instance, in communicating with the animals you're working with now, which do you believe is more important, to get them to do what you want or to actually have them understand?
I think the understanding is enormously more important than getting them to do what I want. There's another related area here. This is the Skinner box. I don't know how familiar this object is, or this concept, to this company. B.F. Skinner is a psychologist, mainly working with animals, rats, and rhesus monkeys and pigeons, and has drawn up a very considerable mass of recipe for how to teach these various animals to do various sorts of things, to get them to do what he wants. These recipes, and I think really I can only talk at this moment to those who've met this business. I don't want to go into the whole of Skinnerian theory at this time of night. These recipes, essentially, to begin with, they work. I'm employed in Oceanic Institute, which has attached to it a commercial company, Sea Life Park, which gives porpoise shows. And people pay at the door and enter and see porpoises do ballets. The porpoises are trained by Skinnerian training, or training based on Skinnerian theory. This is a very arid theory, and many humanists are rather shocked by it, and I think quite rightly. It is a very arid theory, and it can be done by an electronically controlled box just as well as by contact with a living human being. The solution of this, I think, the question is, why does it work? Anything so inhuman ought not to work. One wishes it wouldn't. And I think the answer is that the Skinnerian rules are in fact the rules for cross-species communication. They are the rules for how you are to get across to another creature with whom you share no major premises, how you are to get across to that creature that you want him to go through certain sorts of gyrations. And I think the Skinner box may be very useful when we finally get in touch with the inhabitants of Mars or similar places, when we shall say, not take me to your leader, but take me to your Skinner box. But this is one of the chips off the cybernetic core which threatens, I think, to diminish our humanity rather than to increase it.
What is your opinion as to, say, the probabilities of using systems or cybernetic theory to reduce the number of random variables within the system?
Use of cybernetics to reduce the number of random variables within the system. No, I don't think that is what happens. I think what has happened is will happen is an increase of our understanding of the scope of variability of the random variables and how they interrelate. I mean, if you're building a new system, yes, you have some choice of what variables you're going to put in it. But that's another question.
I'd like to ask you a question on a much different level and with considerable trepidation for my own lack of knowledge about history. But I am a determinist myself, and it always disturbs me to find causes plucked out of history as though they themselves were free events. I would wonder, for example, here, how old the tiger was at the time of, say, the Franco-Prussian War, and whether if he were asked to explain the important events, he might attribute his position to that time as being the important setting determiner. Are you with me? I would think, for example, my generation might explain world events in terms of the events of the Great Depression.
As to the Depression, that can be answered quickly. I was not around. I was in New Guinea for most of that period. And this is not part of my historic background, really, in direct experience. Now, the question of determinism and the cutoff point of explanation is really the question. Of course, there is no cutoff point. We have a system which exists at a given instant. It existed at the previous instant, and the previous instant, and the previous instant, and as you go back, if you slice it, you're going to get different cross-sections for any given moment of time. On the other hand, we deal with something which is a little more limited than that, really, because we deal with people's view of that continuum. And people's view of that continuum is punctuated. It's punctuated, for one thing, by their birth and death. They only see, in any sort of direct experience, a very limited section of that total time sequence. But it's punctuated more profoundly, I think, by the fact that people are punctuating organisms. This is part of the natural history of the people we deal with, that they do, in fact, slice it this way. This is not a contribution to the philosophy of the nature of time or the nature of causation or anything of the kind. It's a natural history observation of the sorts of organism we deal with, and these are organisms which will, in fact, be affected by the continuum as if the continuum were made of segments. And they will impose the segmentation. Way over there.
I was just going to ask if George Creel had been a student of cybernetics, he would not have had the temerity to exert the influence that you say he did.
I hope he would not, sir. I'm not the protector of George Creel's morals, but I think he would have been a little more aware that he was, in fact, doing a very dangerous thing. It's awfully hard to judge hindsight, you know.
I'm not sure if I can word this very briefly, but having had 4 years experience with an IBM computer as a programmer, I also came to realize a great humility as to what we can control and the great extent of variability. On the other hand, it seems, would it not, that we also learn through cybernetics a tremendous appreciation of humanity's potential in the very fact that we are flexible. We are infinitely flexible. And it seems that perhaps the next revolution might be in terms of education and training, or a vision in education to develop the creativity that is in each of us so that we can be responsive at the moment, not in terms of last year's patterns or 10 years' patterns ago, but now. Do you agree with this, or what is your thought?
I disagree with one point, as I understood it, namely with the notion that we are infinitely flexible. I'm not quite sure what is meant by the word we here. Would you mean that a given working society of human beings at a given moment is infinitely flexible? And it certainly is not, because it's...
No, I mean that the human being itself, that we have not at all tapped our potentiality as a species, as individuals and as a species.
That is true.
And that this is the task of education, to discover how this can be done and to do it.
It is true we have not tapped human capacity to more than, 10 or 15% maybe. On the other hand, the pragmatic limitations on being able to tap that, I think, are demonstrated on the whole by cybernetics. To go back to the determinism question that you put up, which is related to this, I too am a determinist, but if you study human societies and human behavior in societies, and there is no human behavior which isn't in societies, even if they're all alone on a desert island, they still go through gyrations related to the societies from which they came. When you study these things, it's not so much that you are aware of studying a deterministic system, but of studying an over-determined system, that the factors and interactive forces, it's a horrid word, an inappropriate one, which determine how I will stand as I lean on this lectern, as you begin to analyze them back into my height, the height of the lectern, the way in which my father stood under various circumstances, the way in which my colleagues stand, the way in which you expect me to stand, and so on and so on and so on. And the messages I want to give to you by standing in certain ways and so on. This becomes, in the end, a very definitely determined and restrained system. And this goes for presidential decisions just as much as for minute postural details of how I behave. That the spread of freedom at any given moment is extraordinarily small. Even the spread of possible random alternatives is very small.
I was a little disturbed by one implication of your talk, at least that I got, and that is that our attitudes and perhaps our beliefs are determined just by the events that occur during our own lifetimes, and eliminating any possibility of the influence of vicarious experience or study. That no doubt was not your intention, but I was just...
No, sir.
The suggestion that has come in two or three times suggests that possibility.
No. I was not... In fact, I think I was rather stressing that the vicarious experience influences us very profoundly, but does not do so in the same direction that it influenced the carrier of the vicarious experience. I mean, that my experience, having been alive when the Versailles Treaty was drawn up, as transmitted now to people in their 20s, hits them entirely differently from the way it hit me. It gets passed on it gets passed on, usually not being labeled as having had anything to do with Versailles, but as a rather negative and cynical philosophy about life, for which they don't know the justification. The point I made was that it does influence them, but they come in as into the middle of a movie without having known the beginning of it. It is conceivably possible for us to do so. You will be awfully lucky if they will trust you that much in the present epoch.
Do you think that cybernetics will eclipse individual initiative in the coming years?
I'm sorry, sir, I missed the question.
Do you think cybernetics will eclipse individual initiative in the coming years? In other words, the machine will tell us what to do instead of us telling what the machine will do?
Philosophically, an awfully difficult question, sir. I don't know, when I'm driving a car, how much it controls me. Does it eclipse me? Of course, it controls me in a great many ways. Acceleration and deceleration is now that of the car and not that of myself. Well, cars accelerate and decelerate more than human beings do, perhaps. But still, I'm limited to its mechanics.
Yeah, but in other words, you tell what the car...
But I decide that it'll go to Sacramento rather than going to San Francisco, I guess, still.
Yeah, yes, but the car doesn't tell you where you're going to go, right?
I think not.
Right. So, in other words, do you think someday that the machine will tell people what to do over their...
Yeah. What I don't know how to discriminate is between the machine telling me what to do and the machine telling me how to do things. The machine is certainly going to tell me how to do whatever it is, but it pushes me to a higher logical type in my decisions. I sacrifice decision at the lower level in order to have more freedom at a higher level. I think that's roughly what it comes to.
I'm interrupting at this point because there are a number of students who have examinations tomorrow and are already experiencing the anxiety of having to read 500 pages before 8 o'clock in the morning. But Mr. Bateson is quite agreeable to answering questions to those of you who would like to come up to the podium afterwards. And I want to thank Mr. Bateson very much.